Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.
Today on Valley Edition, we learn about a new program aimed at reducing gun violence in cities around California. Social justice groups are hoping to bring it to Fresno, but some critics argue it pays gang members to cooperate.
And later, we talk postpartum depression with a stand-up comedian. And we interview a reporter at the Fresno Bee about Congressman T.J. Cox's undisclosed business ties.
But first, police officers have the power to take a person's life. But when they choose to use that extraordinary power often comes down to a judgment call. Now, records released under California's new police transparency law are giving the public unprecedented insight into the moments when those life and death decisions are made. Today, Alice Daniel and I will take you through a deadly force incident in the small city of Hanford. Just a note to our listeners, some of the audio is very graphic.
Two people are dead and a canine officer is recovering in the hospital after an officer-involved shooting in Kings County.
It's November 27th, 2017. ABC 30 in Fresno is reporting a story about a murder suspect who shot and killed his girlfriend in the small town of Lemoore.
The suspect was tracked down by authorities, leading to a chase and violent confrontation.
We know how that confrontation unfolded thanks to body cam and audio released by the Hanford Police Department. Officer Jeff Davis first hears a dispatch about the shooting around 3 p.m. Minutes later, he notices a blue Dodge Charger at a traffic stop. He checks the license plate numbers he's written on his hand from the BOL, or Be on the Lookout.
I put two and two together and I thought, well, this has got to be the suspect in the Lemoore shooting.
That's Davis talking to investigators later, after the confrontation ends. The driver of the blue Dodge, Juan Luis Castro, sees him and pulls around another car. Davis and several other officers pursue him, speeding along rural roads, hitting 100 miles an hour.
Okay, we got CHP about a mile in front of us. Looks like they're going to put spikes out.
Davis radios his boss, Corporal Chris Barker.
Hey, if we slow down to anything under 30, code 4 to do a pit maneuver.
Davis is hoping they'll slow down enough so he can bump Castro's car and spin it. That's a pit maneuver. They want to bring this chase to an end.
And as soon as it spun, I gave it a little bit of throttle.
Okay.
And his car spun, and I looked at him. We were just feet apart.
You guys got him. He just got pitted.
The chase ends, and here, Alice picks up the story.
Castro's car is disabled. Four other police cars pull up around him. The officers are yelling. Corporal Barker starts calling the shots.
One at a time, one at a time. Keep your hands up. Get your other one up.
Four officers have their guns pointed at Castro, who's still sitting in his Dodge Charger. They can't see if he's got a gun. The open passenger door is blocking their view. Barker tries to force Castro to show him both hands.
Crawl out. Get on the ground. You can. Do it now.
Barker's considering his options. He looks in his car trunk.
Oh, I ain't got my less lethal.
He doesn't have his less lethal beanbag shotgun. The suspect's left hand is up, but it's hard to follow his right hand.
Keep your hand where we can see it. Keep that hand up. Don't do anything. Come on. Just listen to us, all right?
An officer next to Barker asks if he should try to taser him.
I don't want to chance it.
Barker doesn't think there's a clear enough shot to taser. Castro's right hand goes down again.
Keep your hands up! Keep your hands up! Put your hand up! Put your hand up!
Castro's hands remain down, and he mumbles something about his family, how they're going to kill him. Barker is wondering how this is going to end. Here's what he tells investigators later.
This is going to go to suicide by cop or a suicide or shoot it out with us. I mean, he's basically saying is, I can't surrender. I can't fall to the ground.
Another minute has gone by. Castro still won't show his hands.
We don't want to do this. Put your hands up.
A less lethal option arrives. A sheriff's dog.
Canine dog. We got a canine here.
Come on, man. Just let us help you.
Castro says, just let me breathe.
Okay, we've been letting you breathe, okay?
After minutes of deadlock, Officer Davis senses a shift in Castro.
At one point, I saw the guy start breathing real heavy. And I told Chris, I said, Corporal Barker, I said, hey, this guy's starting to breathe heavy. Something's going to happen.
He may be armed, so we don't know if he's armed or not.
Now the canine starts barking. The deputy, Dakota Fosnett, is going to send his dog in.
Last chance.
Unless Castro starts cooperating. Castro doesn't move. Fosnett releases the dog. It runs at Castro, snarling. Castro's right hand finally comes out, holding a gun. He shoots at the dog. Fosnett and Barker fire back.
The guy kind of starts coming forward, and Fosnett starts shooting, and then I see the gun.
Shots fired.
I think the one that hit the dog went through the dog, and it bounced up, and I heard it right by my ear.
Castro falls to the ground.
The gun falls out of his hand.
Everybody good.
He's looking at me. His eyes basically roll back in his head. And so I looks like the threat stopped. I kicked the gun out of the way.
Clearing the gun. We're clear.
Officers move in. The canine deputy still has his gun trained on Castro and checks him for a pulse. Then he remembers his dog.
Hold on.
Did you shoot my dog?
I think you got hit.
Hey, you guys want to transport his dog, go with him to help him with his dog?
Officers holster their guns and pull on gloves to secure the scene. Castro is declared dead.
You had made reference a couple different times about being in fear for your officers, for yourself. What were your fear of?
Us going home at the end of the night, making it out alive. This suspect just killed somebody. And if he's willing to kill some random person or whoever it may be, why isn't he going to do the same thing for us? We give him plenty of opportunity to surrender, and he chose not to.
The investigation agreed with Barker, finding the shooting lawful.
Police also found that Juan Castro had earlier shot and killed his girlfriend, Danielle Dever, in her home. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Laura Satsui. This story was edited by Suki Lewis and Alex Emsley at KQED in San Francisco. It was produced as part of a statewide media collaborative investigating newly released police documents.
Three cities in California are trying something different when it comes to reducing gun violence. It's a controversial method that pays people for their progress, but it's showing promise in the city that's been doing it the longest. Valley Public Radio's Monica Velez reports on why some Fresno community groups want to bring it here.
Aaron Foster stands outside Wayne's Liquor Store on East California Avenue. People walk in and out, cars whiz by with their windows down, music turned up.
This is the heart of Southwest Fresno. And
Foster has lived in this neighborhood since he was 16. Before that, he would spend every summer here. He says people can congregate in this area. It's not gang territory.
And there's rival gang members that come by, but they know this is the safe zone.
There's a park across the street where at least two dozen people are hanging out.
So it's honor amongst thieves. Criminals don't come around here and shoot because of the old people that live here. So we call this the old man park. It's called Pride Park, but we call it the old man park, and you can come here and deal with the old people. Play dominoes, chess, poker, whatever you want, barbecue, fish, whatever you need.
But Foster wants the rest of his community to feel safe, so he's fighting gun violence.
I've lost two children due to gun violence, 4 years apart. They both died the same day, the same way. And they both died Memorial weekend. They both died around 12 midnight.
They were both shot in the back of the head. His son was 21 and his daughter was 18.
My daughter went to her brother's memorial that morning, and she died that night. So that's my thing. But before I lost children, I was part of the problem. I'm a gang member, ex-gang member.
According to police, on average, 75 to 80% of homicides in Fresno are gun-related. It's why Foster wants the city to adopt a program called Advanced Peace. It focuses on the people who are most likely to be, or already are, involved in gun violence.
That includes mentoring, street outreach, case management, cognitive behavioral therapy, life skills training, and subsidized employment.
That's Devon Bogan, the founder and CEO of the nonprofit Advance Peace. He started the program in 2010 in Richmond, a Bay Area city that was notorious for shootings. In the first 6 years, 84 people or fellows participated, and gun violence there has steadily declined.
94% of our fellows are alive today. 83% of them haven't been injured by a firearm today. And 77% of those individuals have not been named as a suspect in a new firearm crime since becoming a fellow.
He says law enforcement and other community organizations have contributed to these successes. An Advance Peace is not a quick fix. It takes a long-term investment. With the help of a case manager, fellows create a life map over a period of 18 months to outline their goals. They also have a chance to travel.
When we travel outside of California or outside of the United States of America, and we do several times a year, the only difference is that they have to be willing to travel with someone that they have a challenge with, someone that they would consider their enemy, so to speak.
Last year, Sacramento and Stockton also started Advance Peace. Cities make a five-year, $1.5 million commitment. Advance Peace provides another $1.5 million. After 5 years, the city is on its own.
And now you've got a well-oiled machine. It's now there. It's been there for 5 years. It's produced. It's demonstrated success.
And homicides are costly. A study from Iowa State University, using data from 2003, found a homicide on average cost society $17.25 million. That's if you consider the financial impact to the family, the government, the courts, the hospital, the police department, and more. A 2010 study by the RAND Corporation, a nonprofit research center, found the cost averages around $8.5 million. At least one Fresno City Council member says the city should consider adding Advance Peace to the budget. Miguel Aria says the project has a lot of community support in his district, which includes parts of Southwest Fresno. But here's the controversial part. After 6 months, fellows can earn up to $1,000 a month based on their achievements. Some critics see that as a bribe, paying people not to shoot each other. But Simon Biasel, who's with Faith in the Valley Fresno, says that's a simplistic way of looking at it. He thinks Fresno should invest.
What I think is valuable about Advance Peace is this idea of bringing humanity back to the individuals who are oftentimes treated as part of a system.
The program also benefits greatly if there's police support. Here's Fresno Police Chief Jerry Dyer.
I'm always willing to work with organizations that have a common goal of reducing violence in a city, as long as that is their true motive, and their motive is not driven by money. Because I have seen over the years that there are far too many organizations that are in it for the wrong reason, where they began to chase the money.
Dyer says gang members are either suspects or victims in the majority of fatal shootings. He says there are other organizations in Fresno with goals similar to Advance Peace, like Street Saints, which offers youth programs in gang prevention and intervention. The police department also works with ex-gang members to help prevent shootings.
We've paid former gang members to come out to the scene. We have a Street 8 outreach program where when we have a shooting, we contact them. They respond to the scene. They find out what happened, who might be the next person who is going to be retaliated against. They work with the gang members to try to get them not to retaliate.
Back in Southwest Fresno, Foster and I take a drive around the neighborhood. We pass rundown parks, basketball courts where kids are playing, and a few memorials with candles and flowers set up on sidewalks and parking lots. We drive by a store and Foster points to it.
That was the store that had three men get killed within 2 years. So this is what our neighborhood looks like.
He says it's why the city needs something like Advance Peace.
Our culture tells us to retaliate and avenge murder. We don't know how to deal with death in any other way. It's hard to tell. I say it all the time. My favorite saying is it's easier to take peanut butter off of bread than to tell one of these young men not to avenge one of their fallen friends.
Advance Peace and local advocates, including Foster, will meet with Mayor Lee Brand and Chief Dyer this week in hopes of gaining their support. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Monica Velez.
Before Andreas Borges was elected to the state Senate in November, he had been a Fresno City Council member and later a county supervisor. I caught up with him recently to ask about the legislation he's prioritizing and what it's like to work in an office where party politics are more commonplace, especially after spending 10 years in technically nonpartisan local positions. And so you represent the 8th Senate District, which encompasses areas as north as Amador and Calaveras counties, all the way to Fresno and Tulare counties. Before this, you were elected last year, and you were at the time Fresno County Supervisor. So now you represent a much larger region than just Fresno County. And in making that transition, I mean, what is it like to hear and address concerns that maybe aren't Fresno-based?
Well, it's certainly it's a very very much a new experience, and just by way of background, Senate District 8 is one of those really large districts, as you mentioned. So there's certainly a very diverse community when it goes from the urban areas of Fresno to the foothill and mountain areas up north. So there's a lot of different priorities, a lot of different issues. So to compare it to my experience at the local level, starting first on the Fresno City Council and then the Board of Supervisors, some of the big differences, and there are quite a few, is that at the local level, you're dealing with more of the local issues, you know, whether it's road repair or public safety and those issues, those types of local issues. At the state level, you can still be dealing with road repairs, but you're certainly doing it across a state that has approximately 40 million people and is the fifth largest economy in the world. So the complexity is certainly more significant, even though the issues at the local level, you're the one, when you go to the supermarket or to Starbucks, people pull you aside and say, hey, have you seen that tree on the corner of Maple? We need to make certain that it's not uprooting the sidewalk anymore. So I think you lose a bit of that connectivity that you would have at the local level, and you sacrifice that by going at the state. But it's very exciting, and the legislative process is really it's thrilling.
I want to turn now to being co-author of a bill or co-sponsor that would increase the penalties for hit and run drivers. It was brought forward by fellow Valley legislator Assemblyman Jim Patterson, in part because of the death of it was back in September of Clovis Vice Principal Gavin Gladding. He was killed by a driver who later fled the scene. And so, can you talk about how this bill, which has been nicknamed Gavin's Law, would impact potential hit and run crimes?
Yes, I think that really this issue really resonated in our community based on the tragic loss that we experienced. And the idea is, why would you want to incentivize individuals to flee from the scene of a crime? In some instances, and I think the author of the bill, Assemblymember Jim Patterson, who has been a leading force in this effort on the Assembly side, was making comment at the press conference that we attended, is that if an individual has been driving under the influence and they were in an accident or hurt someone, the way that the law exists right now is that it almost incentivizes them to flee the scene of the crime and in the process possibly hide their alcohol limit by the time that the authorities would get in contact with them. And so what this bill would do would increase the penalty for those that engaged in a hit and run. But I think it's resonating across the state that sometimes laws have to be improved upon. And this is an example. And it was put through committee. I think there are some challenges with some of the folks who are critical of these types of enhancements, but we're optimistic and we're hopeful that the next reading in committee will allow it to go through.
Mm-hmm. I do want to ask, I mean, is criminal justice and sort of reforming that in various ways, is that something you hope to address more as a state senator, or is your involvement really because this was a local accident and really hit home for a lot of your constituents?
Well, I think criminal justice is often, it would be inappropriate to look upon it as limited to just the crime or the criminal. And I think if we focus our efforts also on looking upon victims' rights, and we saw recently when the governor had put a moratorium on the death penalty, And I certainly was not in favor of that. And I think a lot of folks in our area are not in favor of that, because it's not a ban on the death penalty. It's basically a political deferral, if you will, meaning that the governor has decided that for right or wrong, that he does not want to have these individuals complete their sentence in a terminal way, that it be deferred to the next administration. And I think, you know, from the Fresno standpoint and the surrounding areas, we have some history of our own. I think the mass murderer Wesson is an example of an individual mm-hmm. who is not going to be put to death because of this moratorium. So he killed 9 people in the Fresno area, and I think a lot of folks were expecting justice to be served. So when we talk about criminal reform, we also have to look upon victims' rights.
And I want to turn now to high-speed rail, which I know in the past you've said, acknowledged that the cost has grown, obviously, from what we thought. That seems to happen often, and that's true. The cost has grown. But I wanted to ask, are you opposed to the vision of high-speed rail, to building it in the first place?
Well, I think those were discussions, you know, 10 years ago on whether individuals were in a position of supporting or opposing. Mm-hmm. And the will of the California voters was that they wanted to take this step forward. And there was a price tag attached to that bill. And I think the voters expected that they were going to get what they were promised. And I think folks have seen their hopes dashed in many ways. And I think over a period of time, people who were normally open-minded to the idea of high-speed rail kind of soured to the overall implementation, is because we were asking businesses to relocate. We were forcing them in certain instances to do so. And we didn't know if we were going to get the project that we were promised. And one of the great things that I think happened was when Governor Newsom had his State of the State,
right.
He out of the gate said, "This has not turned out as we had envisioned. We need to take a critical eye to this and figure out, is this a project that still is viable?" And I think the jury is still out on whether or not it is commercially viable and whether it would actually come to pass. Because in its miniaturized form, as only being a valley-connected type of transportation, I don't think that alone is going to prove itself to be financially sustainable.
And then our last little bit of time here. So you've been in office in some way or another for 10 years now, mostly throughout Fresno. And so looking there, I want to ask, how are things different today from, you know, when you were first elected back in 08-09?
Oh, you know what? I think one of the greatest things that I've taken away from my time at the local level is that we are nonpartisan at the city of Fresno and Fresno County. All elected offices do not have partisan labels attached to a name at the ballot box. And I think the beauty of that is that, especially being highlighted in today's political climate, people want representatives who are pragmatic, who are civil, who will work with everyone, even those with whom they may philosophically disagree. And I've taken that to heart. So those years at the local level on a nonpartisan basis, I think have really formed my approach to public service, is that even though I may have my philosophical leanings on a given issue, I am more prepared than I think I otherwise would have been had I not had local experience in working with folks from across the aisle on any given issue that where there's mutual interest.
And so even though, for example, perhaps even though you are a conservative or might have an R next to your name when you're running for senator, even though California, the state legislature, is very Democratic, you feel you can work with your colleagues?
Absolutely. We already have, I think, very good traction because people look upon us as problem solvers. Mm-hmm. My office and me as an individual, I want to work with people. I want to get things done. I want to improve our valley way of life. I want to improve California, not just for today, but for tomorrow, and help restore what we call that California dream. And if you are, as a partisan, are only looking through the lens of philosophical purity or are unwilling to work with others, then I think you're doing a disservice to the constituents you represent. And that's why I'm thankful that we are looking after everyone's interest.
All right. We have been speaking to Senator Andreas Borges, recently elected to the State Senate, formerly of the Fresno County Board of Supervisors. Senator, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Laura. Thanks for the opportunity.
Next week is Black Maternal Health Week, which aims to celebrate African American mothers while raising awareness of the risks of preterm birth and maternal mortality. The March of Dimes will be hosting a kickoff event in Southwest Fresno on Saturday. The keynote speaker will be Angelina Spicer, a stand-up comedian based in Los Angeles who experienced her own trauma after giving birth to a baby girl 4 years ago. I spoke with Spicer about her upcoming performance and using humor to get through hard times.
Performing stand-up before I had my daughter was always a way for me to tell my own story. And I used to talk a lot about what people didn't know about me just from looking at me. Like, people looking at me didn't know that I speak fluent Spanish because I studied abroad. People didn't know that I am an opinionated, loud Black woman who's married to a straight-laced, nerdy white guy. People didn't know these things about me. So that was sort of my message when I first started doing stand-up. Then I had a baby, and then it became way more serious. I felt like I needed to tell the truth about having broken lady parts. My mission in like performing stand-up really feels like something that I have to say.
But it seems like your material now isn't so much even just about like the physical aspects of childbirth and what that does to your body, but also what it did to you mentally. I mean, you know, you were struggling with postpartum depression, and that's taken on a big part of your work as well.
Yeah. I mean, my first entry point into the jokes was the physical shock of becoming a mother, because I was so ashamed about what I went through with postpartum depression that I couldn't like find it funny yet.
I mean, before we even get to the comedy part of it, I mean, just tell me a little bit about what you experienced. I mean, like, what happened to you after your child was born?
After I had my daughter, I didn't experience what people tell you should experience. Like, I didn't have like this joyous, you know, overflow of happy emotions and rainbows and butterflies. I was afraid. There's a picture of me with my daughter laying on me skin to skin with the umbilical cord still attached, and it looks like I have just been in a gang fight. I looked wrecked. I was afraid. I was scared. I was panicked, and I wanted a do-over. That was my first reaction. And the sleepless nights, lack of food, lack of self-care, it just got worse after that. And, you know, after that, I tried to like talk to family about it or my girlfriends about it. And everyone just perpetuated this lie that, you know, they never went through it. They didn't understand what I was going through. They dismissed it as the baby blues. And I just felt so alone and isolated. I like literally was trying to pray it away. Because I'm Black, and that's what Black people tell you to do. Just pray, pray. Jesus will take it. And when that didn't work, I went to therapy. And my therapist is the one who had me admitted to the psychiatric facility for treatment of postpartum depression.
And so, you know, what was involved in deciding to make that a part of your comedy routine then?
As a comedian, I process big life changes on stage. Like, that's how I work through things. Because as a funny person, any kind of unusual experience in life, you're trying to think of how to make it funny. And that was the same thing with the postpartum, except this meant more to me. It felt important. It felt like, why am I the only one talking about this? Why is everybody so afraid to say this? And the reason why it's such a perpetual problem is because nobody's saying anything. Like, the lies have got to stop. The misnomers have got to stop. You know, the fake news, the false advertising has got to stop. Where are the real images of motherhood?
Yeah, I mean, and that sounds like a really
hard task to be able to tackle through stand-up comedy. How do you do that?
It is really hard. It is really hard. You know, I do that with a lot of bombing. You know, I go on stage and I tell the truth about what I'm really feeling. And some audiences, a lot of audiences, as I'm working through it, they worry. They admire my bravery, but they worry. They're like, are you okay now? Like, is everything okay? I'm like, yeah, we can laugh about it now. But the process of mining your truth or mining your tragedy for comedy is an arduous, triggering process. That's why I feel like people need to see this documentary. So with the documentary, we are doing a really entertaining, palatable way for people to get this information and to see their own experiences live out on screen. We've got animation in the documentary. We've got a live comedy special in the documentary. And we also have interviews from my own therapist, my own husband, my own mom, all of the caregivers in my life who came to rescue me during that time. And we really show and dig deep into how caregivers and significant others and husbands can help their loved ones when they think that they're in need. We're still in the crowdfunding phase for it. We've raised about $30,000 so far with over 300 backers for this, but we just need a little bit more to keep it going and to actually shoot the comedy special. So we don't have corporate backers. We don't have large sponsors. This film is 100% crowdfunded.
So you've brought the subject, postpartum depression, what it can do to women. You've brought that to the stage. You're producing this documentary about it. You really felt like there was a vacuum out there in terms of how much the public knows about this issue. I mean, what kind of feedback have you gotten from people? Have you heard this from other women as well, you know, that they wanted to know more about this or they needed to know more about it?
You know, when I perform in comedy clubs, I feel like it's a new wave of the Me Too movement. You know, mothers and women, not even mothers, like young millennial women, like everybody comes up to me and are like, thank you for telling the truth. Like I had the water bottle, the water spray bottle too. I had the gauze. I sat on the frozen bananas. Like I went through that too. No, I don't talk about it, but I'm happy you do. And men are like completely enthralled because they've seen loved ones have babies and maybe at times have felt helpless, or they realize that they're not ready for kids right now. So they're like, thank you for buying me some time. Thank you. You got my girlfriend off my back. She saw your set and she's like, you know what? Mm-mm, no kids for us right now.
I want to follow up on the spray bottle and the frozen banana, but we'll pass on those for right now. But so is it, you know, looking back at your career trajectory, I mean, you've been a comedian for over a decade. I mean, did you ever think that you would also, you know, be a spokeswoman for maternal health?
You know, I never thought that I'd be a spokeswoman of any kind. I never thought that, you know, my being admitted to a psychiatric facility would be material for me. I never thought that any of my life's work would all come down to being depressed. You know, I never thought that. That's why I call myself an accidental activist, because this was not in the plan.
So what will you be talking about in your performance this coming Saturday in Fresno?
In Fresno, I'm so excited to be there. In Fresno, I'm going to be talking about the documentary, of course. I'm going to also do a keynote presentation and just create a safe space to revolutionize the way we talk, the way we treat, and the way we joke about postpartum depression. I call it my postpartum revolution. You know, I just feel like women need the space to talk about how they felt after they had a kid. Like no shame, no judgment zone, just transparent talk. So that's what we're going to do at the March of Dimes event in Fresno.
Well, great. Angelina Spicer is a stand-up comedian who will be talking about her work and postpartum depression this Saturday in Southwest Fresno as part of Black Maternal Health Week. Angelina, thanks so much.
Thank you. PPD, how can I explain it? It's what the doctors name it.
you're crying, laughing same time with it. P is for post, other for partum after baby.
That's Angelina Spicer riffing on the Naughty by Nature song OPP.
It's a contradiction. These 10 little letters got you stressing here. Awake every 2 hours and the baby ain't gaming. It seems I got to start to explain it.
Freshman Democratic Congressman T.J. Cox has only held his seat for a few months, but he has already aligned himself with party priorities, including a bill to overhaul federal elections. It's unlikely that bill will ever pass, but if it did, Cox himself could be in violation. Fresno Bee Politics reporter Rory Appleton recently wrote about Cox's business interests, as well as his failure to disclose some of his business ties, a mistake that's apparently not uncommon for legislators to make. From member station KQED, reporter Alex Hall asked Appleton about his reporting.
So basically what we had found was through a series of tips, we were sort of alerted to five businesses that TJ Cox was listed on state or in one case Canadian federal records as either a manager, an owner, or on the board of directors that were not present on either of his 2017 campaign disclosure forms or his 2018 campaign disclosure forums. And so we basically put that together in a story while also sort of folding in another tip that we had received that turned out to be accurate, that it looks like he had put his house up for rent several different times in the last couple of years, and were able to check with the county and see that, you know, he had collected a homeowner's tax credit that's not available to people who rent their homes out. So there's a possibility there that he might have to give some money back to the county if he did indeed rent his house out. Last year, when he was running, we had found a similar problem with a home that he owns in Maryland. He was collecting that same tax credit and also renting it out and not living in it regularly. And he did actually end up giving up that money. But mainly the story that we did just focused on, you know, here's five businesses that weren't on his disclosure forms. State records seem to say that he is involved with them, and we're not necessarily trying to say that he needed to disclose them. We just, you know, we just saw that there were five that weren't on the disclosure form. He's working to divest. We thought it was important to have an accurate record of just how many businesses and what their names were that he does actually need to divest from.
And what is the meaning of that? I mean, why is that important?
Yeah, so basically what'll happen is he needs to, you know, sort of distance himself from businesses just because there's a potential for conflict of interest and ethics violations with the House Ethics Committee. And so that's the main issue. It's not necessarily mandatory. I mean, it goes a little, depends on what the business is and depends on what, you know, his roles are in the House. He might, you know, have to sort of not take part in some votes or things like that. But he's taken the step to where he wants to divest from, it seems like, as many as possible, if not all of them, just so that it's quite clear that there are no conflicts of interest. I mean, for example, you know, he is a miner by trade. He is an engineer. That's what his degree is in. Many of his businesses are mining related. He also sits on the House Committee on Natural Resources. So there are things like that where people might, you know, think, oh, that's a little odd, because, you know, he has a hand in making some of the rules for some of the businesses that he also is in charge of. So I think he's looking to try and just get rid of any of that kind of conflict.
What was the most striking thing that you found in your reporting?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the Canadian company. I mean, that's an interesting one. That's one that is of extra interest just because Cox and many of his Democratic counterparts are very, very have put their full weight behind this H.R. 1, the first bill that the Democrats put forward in the new House, which calls for more transparency in elections, calls for improved voting rights, calls for improved transparency in terms of the candidates. You know, it would require presidential candidates to submit tax returns, for example, things like that. And one of the stipulations in there is that members of Congress would not be allowed to serve in on for-profit boards, which he serves on many right now. And then there's also a significant amount, it doesn't come out clearly and say that you could not be a part of a foreign company, but there's a lot in there about what they call foreign agents and trying to distance yourself from, as a Congress member or a staffer or any number of things, from foreign interests. And so having a Canadian company, I mean, there are some real questions to be answered there.
And I know there was a McClatchy reporter who asked him about this, right? I mean, what did he say?
So basically that reporter had asked him about his, specifically about the status of his divesting. Like, you know, how's that going? And he basically had to, he was explaining that it takes some time, that when you've been involved in business the way he has 10, 15 years, his primary, you know, one of his primary businesses is actually working with a lot of smaller businesses on getting tax credits for them. So I think he's also gotten to know so many in the business world that he's got small investments here, there, and a nursing home and a development company that's in Granite Park, property management, mining. You know, he's got several nut businesses. And so he's basically saying it takes time to get to sort of clear yourself of all these. And he had one quote in there where he basically said, you know, it's difficult to go to your lenders and say, I own property, and say, oh, I'm a congressman now, I need to get rid of this. It doesn't really work like that. So he's saying it takes a long time, and that he's got a whole team of people working on it. As to, you know, the specifics of our story, his office did not have any official comment on any of thing. So we included the comment that he gave Kate in Washington that sort of speaks to this, but we did ask him directly about the five businesses, as well as the rental issue. We gave them a week to respond, just about, and when it came time to publish, they were not ready to respond in any way, so we went on.
I mean, even if he was still in the process of divesting, mm-hmm. why wouldn't he put that on the form?
I really don't know. I mean, we're not trying to get into any sort of speculation about, you know, whether he forgot or whether he didn't, you know, he didn't think that he had to or anything like that. I mean, our main focus was, you know, here are five that we have found state records and one case federal records that show that they are not on his list. He was listed as an active manager in the last 2 years. The rules on your disclosures is you have to file for the last 2 years, just about. And they're not on there. And we're just sort of, you know, the public, anybody can sort of make whatever decisions they want and ask their congressman, you know, whatever they want about that. But we're trying to just stick to, you know, here are these five businesses. They're not on his list. There you go.
And I know before you mentioned this bill, mm-hmm. and you said in your story, but I'm not sure if you had already said in this conversation, that if that were to pass, he would be in violation of it. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. And he absolutely sits on for-profit boards, many of them. And so absolutely. But I mean, I think it's also fair to say that probably quite a few congressmen and women would be as well. It's a bill that, you know, the House has pushed forward, but probably will never see any life in the Senate. Just one of those sort of situations. So, you know, whether congressmen and women all over the country are scrambling to divest, I don't know. All I know is, you know, what he's told us. We've had several of these stories now about his business interests. We've covered also, extensively his interest in Granite Park with the sports foundation that he has with Terrence Frazier. That was found to have some questionable bookkeeping, standards by the city audit. And then there was also a state, it issued them a letter saying they were delinquent on some of their payments and things like that. So we're covering his business interests very, very closely because, you know, he's making this transition from a very, you know, very, very active businessman, you know, with lots of property, lots of businesses, lots of ties in the community, into a congressman. And the level of scrutiny is much higher. And you know, all those interests that he had as a private citizen, as a businessman, they're public now. We consider that an area of deep public record, and that the public has a right to understand, you know, exactly. And we have received multiple tips, some of which made it into this story, some of which are still being investigated, as to his business ties and things like that. And we take those seriously. We will continue looking into all this.
That was KQED reporter Alex Hall speaking with Rory Appleton of the Fresno Bee. We reached out to Cox's campaign staff about this story, but they declined to comment.
It's time for spring break here in the Valley, which for some families means a vacation. But if you're one of those parents who finds traveling with kids to be daunting, especially when it involves setting up tents and cooking outside, one guidebook series with a spin might help you out. It's called Adventuring with Kids, and its newest installment focuses on Yosemite National Park. I interviewed the authors, husband and wife Harley and Abby McAllister, to learn about what sets their travel guides apart.
The main thing we see with a lot of the information about national parks is that it tends to be focused more towards adults, you know, just sort of like big hikes or, you know, maybe natural history or things that are appealing to adults, you know, because that makes sense. They're the ones that are making most of the decisions naturally. But if you are interested in going to a national park and making sure that your kids have a fun time, what we find is that that requires kind of a different focus and sort of different priorities. And so what we did as we wrote these books is we tried to always keep that in mind. How would we plan where we stay? What are our itineraries are? What our daily schedules would look like? What hikes we would want to do? What other adventures the parks have to offer that would really be fun for our kids?
So what are some kid-specific tips? I mean, what new kind of information, new perspectives are there going to be in this book that maybe wouldn't be in a more typical guidebook?
We sort of, as adults, forget the wonder of seeing, you know, a millipede and its 100 legs crawling across something, you know, even floating stick boats down a little stream. You know, those are the types of things that kids, and I think especially kids these days who tend to grow up in more urban environments and have very structured schedules and, you know, planned lives, they don't have the time to just sort of embrace nature, sort of just get, you know, up close and personal with nature. And so when we're thinking of like what hikes to take with kids, again, we're thinking of like, well, does the hike go near a stream or does it have a place where they can really get involved and get hands-on, up close and personal with nature? We also tend to be in a hurry always, like trying to get to the next objective. And with kids, we find you just need to slow down, let them absorb it at their own pace and not be in a hurry, because that's what's really going to allow them to kind of develop a love and an appreciation for it.
And when in each of our trails that we review, we mention things like that. We mention, oh, this is a great place to stop and have a snack because the kids can play in the water, or there's a bridge here that your kids will, you know, probably enjoy throwing stick boats off of one side and running over to the other side. We also have itineraries that we've put in, which help parents get an idea about how much time, how many things you really should be trying to fit in into a day. So the slower itineraries that we provide allow more time for that exploration and more times for taking breaks and just embracing what's right in front of you instead of hurrying along.
And the two of you, you have plenty of experience with kids. You have 8 children. Do you take them all with you when you go traveling?
Oh, absolutely. Our kids go with us. All these books are kid tested by our own kids. And they've been traveling with us. Our first camping trip with our oldest was when he was 6 months old, and he's about to turn 18 now. So they've been with us through all ages and all stages. And these books are written from those perspectives, from little toddlers and babies all the way up to teenage boys.
Yeah. I mean, are there any really specific pointers in this book that you would never have thought of were it not for your kids?
You know, I think some of the suggestions might be familiar to people, but, you know, It is a little logistically different when you're camping than when you're going on a normal road trip, say where you're staying in a hotel. You know, again, we try to think of camp spots that are near features that will kind of keep the kids engaged and involved in doing something fun on their own while we're, you know, maybe preparing a meal or setting up or taking down tents. You know, and really just another thing that is always true with kids is that they're just less, you know, robust, if you will. You know, they can't deal with weather changes quite as well as we can, and they can't deal with being hungry as well as we can. And their little bodies are burning through a lot of calories really quickly as they're growing. And even just things as simple as always making sure you have lots of snacks. There's been a number of times where we've been, you know, busted along the trail somewhere, and the kids are getting a little grumpy and a little grouchy. And we just find that if you'll take, you know, 5 minutes even to just sit down, get out the water bottles, get out some granola bars, that goes a long ways towards keeping their spirits up.
And I imagine some of these were lessons that you would have learned the hard way and kind of gone, oh, geez, okay, well, now we know how to do that.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And we also, on the snack topic, we're pretty healthy eaters around here. We don't do a lot of sugary sweets and candy and stuff like that. But when we go out on the trail, we lower that bar a little bit because they are burning a lot of energy. So we actually let them all go with us shopping ahead of time and pick out something from the store that'll be a real treat for them. And then they pack their own day packs. And so they know what's in their backpacks. And so we'll say, you know, when we get to whatever point X or in 10 minutes, we're going to stop and you can pick your treat out of your backpack. They know that they're looking forward to that. It'll keep them going. And then they sit down, they enjoy that snack, and then they're ready to go again.
So what is nice specifically about Yosemite when it comes to traveling with kids?
Well, Yosemite, we really, really enjoyed exploring with our kids. We felt like each of the regions had something different and really amazing to offer. So that was really fun. We felt like it was a great place where we could challenge our older teens, and the little ones found plenty to enjoy on a much smaller scale.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if you're going there primarily to see the valley, I think you have to have some expectations as far as, you know, because one of the things I like about the outdoors is just sort of the solitude and being able to hear the breeze and you know, and sort of soak in the nature. And you know, if you're going to be in the Yosemite Valley during the summer, there's going to be some crowds. You know, you're going to see some amazing sights, but you're going to be surrounded by a lot of people. And I think that's why one of the things I loved about Yosemite is that you can go up to that Tuolumne Meadows region and really leave a lot of that behind. Once we got up there, a lot fewer people, a lot of trails to some really beautiful alpine lakes, and you just really feel just sort of the beauty of nature up there. And, you know, you can go do either of those things, or you can even go down to the Wawona area, which has some of the big sequoia trees and also some old time, you know, kind of country western barns and horse rides and wagon rides and things like that to get a little more of that kind of pioneer spirit of things. So you can really tailor your vacation to kind of what kind of experience you're looking for.
So if there were some parents listening to this who, you know, who really are not sure if they can go outdoors with their kids, haven't really given it a shot yet, you know, what would your one piece of advice be for them?
Well, I think it is easy to overdo it. And so I would encourage people not to be timid and not to be afraid to try. But I would also say don't make your first hike with your kids, you know, 5 miles in each direction with a huge elevation gain, you know, in the hottest part of the day where there's not a lot of shade, you know. But again, the great thing about, you know, the book or just in Yosemite in general is that it does have some shorter hikes that still have big payoffs in terms of like beautiful vistas, amazing views, and things like that. And that's true both in the Yosemite and in Tuolumne Meadows.
I would also add that we always say start slow, and Harley's talking about picking a hike that would start slow. If you were going to try to go camping, we often say try to camp in your backyard for a night or two and see how your kids enjoy that. Kind of work the kinks out, what's comfortable, what's not comfortable, are they afraid, are they not afraid. Take hikes that way, take the camping that way, see how it goes first.
Great. Well, Harley and Abby McAllister are the authors of a new guidebook called Adventuring with Kids Yosemite National Park. Harley and Abby, thank you so much.
It was our pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can find all this and more on our website, kvpr.org, or download the podcast. We're on Facebook and Instagram at Valley Public Radio and on Twitter at kvpr.
Our app is called KVPR, and it's available for free in app stores on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by me, my co-host Laura Satsui, reporter Monica Velez, and our news director, Alice Daniel.
Technical support by Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Laura Satsui.
And I'm Carrie Klein. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2020 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, featuring Listening to Mothers in California, a new survey with insights into maternity care in the Golden State, on the web at chcf.org.